Bradley J, Kermit the Frog, and Fozzie Bear, right?
Yes.
There's the two of them.
One of the great friendships in fictional history.
Right, and a frog and a bear, who can say no to that? Here is my question to you. You transpose that to real life. Which one of us is Fozzie the Bear, and which one of us is Kermit the Frog? Brad Geiger, Dave Kellett, we're moving right along. We're going down in our old Studebaker, going down the road.
Truly one of the better songs in musical movie history. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
moving right along. You wash the dishes to that song. Those dishes get done 30% faster.
Absolutely. I think if I had to say, I am definitely much more a Fozzie Bear than you. In other words, I am much more apt to say the first thing that comes to my mind if I think it's going to make you laugh, even if it's dumb. Sometimes if it's inappropriate, all the times never thought through. But if I think I can get you to laugh, I will absolutely say that. And I've proven that on this show 100 times. Whereas you are much more earnest. You're much more considerate and thoughtful and straightforward. And you are, without a doubt, the Kermit the Frog character that's always kind of thinking about where does everybody fit in this. Meanwhile, me, it's, you know, where's my rubber chicken? And I'll say it, and if Statler and Waldorf boo, then so be it.
So first of all, you managed to turn that into quite of a compliment, and I really appreciate that. But I actually also think that you are Fozzie, mainly for the vaudevillian jokes. You're like, you walk into, I've walked into, like, diners with you or walk into a room or walk into Comic-Cons, and you're immediately like, oh, look at this salt shaker. I've got six jokes about salt shakers. Blah, blah. Hey. I'm Brad Geiger. It's Vaudeville. And they're all jokes from like 1925, which is kind of what Henson and company did with Fozzie. Those were all old jokes that Fozzie had.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of my favorite aspects of you is that somehow you have like an encyclopedia of old vaudeville jokes that like I'll say a word like giraffe and you'll like have nine jokes about a giraffe ready to go.
Yeah. One of the most horrible things in the animal kingdom is a giraffe with a sore throat. But it was that same.
For God's sakes. All right. Well, that's been Comic Lab. We're done. I'm out. The only counter side to this is that if I am Kermit, does that mean that I am both oddly exciting and terrifying to watch ride a bicycle? Is that true?
Yeah, I've seen that happen, and yes, there's a lot of movie magic goes into getting you upright on a bicycle.
A lot of movie magic goes into getting a bike. I gotta tell you, as the years go on, have you ever had this? Because I was out riding the other day, but I was riding in jeans, and I'm just gonna be honest, the jeans were a little tighter than they normally were. Have you ever tried to get on a bike with jeans that are a little bit too tight, and also you're my age? It was not pretty. I had to tilt the bike. I had to kind of get a running start. I'm like going to swing that leg. It wasn't pretty, Brad. I'm just being honest.
Yeah, and you got to try very hard not to embarrass yourself, especially in front of your kids. You do not want to be the dad that falls off his bike and rips his pants.
Yeah, it's the 1-2 punch of fatherdom right there.
Yeah.
And on that note, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc.
And I'm his green friend, Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. And before we go any further, before we take another step, we've got to remind everybody that we are in the final days, the final hours of the Comic Lab cash grab over on Kickstarter. Remember, the URL is comiclabcashgrab.com because it's all about friendship and love. Comiclabcashgrab.com. And remember, this is for getting the 20 Comics Commandments that we did for the 200th episode of Comic Lab on one awesome designed magnet, 5x7 magnet. And then there's two new pins, Comic Lab pins, available as well. So over at comiclabcashgrab.com.
Yeah, you're not going to want to miss it. That's a lot of fun. And again, having those comic commandments right there by your workstation is going to be very, very helpful because it's some of the stuff that we talk about every week. Speaking of which, Dave, do you want to start us off on our first topic for this week?
Oh boy, Brad, do I, because I've got my glasses on and I can actually see my computer. Boy, speaking, what a week of health it's been for me in terms of like, can't get on my bike, can barely see my computer. It's a lot of really strong points for me in terms of like my increasingly aging process. All right, Bradley, our first question comes in from Patrick DeThomas over at patreon.com/comiclab. And Patrick writes, beautiful Brad and delectable Dave. That's all. Oh, come on.
That's
Patrick. You're on the right. You're off to the right. You're on the right footing there starting off that way. Although yes. I would have said beautiful Brad and well, also beautiful Dave. I don't know.
Delectable Dave is perfectly good. You got a problem with delectable? I'd be delectable any day of the week.
Yeah. You know what? Delectable is nice because beautiful you can view from a distance, but delectable you want to. Get up in on that, don't
yeah,
you?
And by the way, I'm much more comfortable with being admired from a distance, whereas you want people to be close to you. So that's actually
true.
Very accurate.
I've told you my longstanding opinion that I will pay to have a masseuse not touch me. I hate strangers touching me. I do not want it. Get away from me. I will pay you to go. The one time my wife was there, like, let's go do a couples massage. I was like, this is terrible. I do not want this. This is exactly what I don't want to do. It's my wife, myself, and Greg. I don't want Greg in here. Get Greg the hell out of here. All right. All right. So here's Patrick's question. All right. I plan on making a trade length 200 to 300 page gravitas comics, and I figure I will post them as a web comic as I make them. Is it a good idea to post a long story like this to a web comic site first and then apply to Image Comics or Kickstarter a physical copy? Could something like Invincible or Saga have been put on a webcomic site first and then taken off to publish? Or is there something I'm missing? Brad, Patrick is asking you, is there something I'm missing?
Yeah, Patrick, I'll tell you what you're missing. About 20 years of comics history, 200 episodes of Comic Lab, 10 years of webcomics.com. What you're talking about is what we all started doing in the year 2000 and then continued doing in 2001 and 2002 and 2003. What you're talking about is nothing new. In fact, what you're describing is exactly what Dave and I advocate very, very strongly on this show week after week after week. When you hear us say stuff like crowdfunding, first comes the crowd, then comes the funding. This is exactly what we're talking about. Put that thing out on a website. Your instinct is exactly right in terms of you thinking that you should have a website. We advocate for that as well. Also use social media for publishing as well as promotion. Use those four C's of social media to try and audience build. And listen to that. I think it was the previous show, Dave, where we talked about long form comics and we talked specifically about some publishing strategies for long form comics. I want you to go back and listen to that episode specifically, but what you're talking about, this idea of building your audience online and then taking it either to, if you choose to take it to a publisher like Image, fine. If you choose to at that point self-publish on Kickstarter, fine. But this idea that you're talking about is what we've been doing for 20 years and something that we advocate very, very strongly.
So first of all, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Second of all, I love a question that triggers just enough piss and vinegar from Brad that this is the answer. So Brad, hi, it's me, Patrick, just asking a friendly question. Am I missing anything? And Brad goes, I'll tell you what you're missing. 20 years of webcomics, 200 episodes of Comic Lab, the entire Encyclopedia Americana, every basic understanding of the English language. I'm Brad Geiger. Just blows up the room, walks out. Bam.
I gotta tell you, this is something. It's my Niagara Falls. It's my Niagara because just the other
that got me mixed up. I almost lost it. It's my Niagara Falls. Slowly, I turned.
It's been 20 years. Just the other day on Twitter, somebody was saying something about: is it still possible to launch a comic strip on the web, or do you have to go to the big syndicates for that? He actually used the phrase.
I saw that. We got added on that one. I saw that too. And I was like, are you kidding me?
He actually used the phrase big syndicates. You know, like you'd say big pharmaceutical or big business. How many syndicates are left at this point? Two? One and a half?
As though they're not going around the office pool scraping together some money to buy some more photocopy
big
toner.
Syndicates.
Like, they're running out of money.
I was going out of my mind. So, and that was just yesterday. So I'm still kind of in that mindset. So when I see something like this, I know it's a little bit churlish for me to say it that way, but I want you to understand, and anybody listening, I want them to understand, this is not new. We've been doing this for 20 years. Get out there and jump in. In other words, the other way of saying that is do not wait another minute. Jump in. The water's fine. This is the time to push that button.
Yeah. And if you remember, Patrick, a few episodes back, we actually talked about what I like to think of as the modern ideal of what a career is.
Yeah.
And so I think I specifically said that this is not a given. It's not easy. It's not even something that the majority of people will get. But my ideal of what the platonic ideal of a comics career right now is, you make a webcomic. It's got a very successful Patreon support and maybe some tchotchke support over the years. You kickstart a book every couple of years. Bada bing, bada bang, bada boom. Then once the book has gotten to a certain enough cultural moment, you bring it to a publisher.
Right.
Now, granted, only 3, 4, 5 different cartoonists have done that specific career, but that's sort of my platonic ideal of maximizing income through Patreon, through Kickstarter, through self-publishing, then bringing it to a publisher and getting that one last big check from them. Aside from that, any one of those options is possible in terms of you start the book this long form story on the web. You're Patreoning it as you go. You're kickstarting it every few years. Even if you never are able to bring it to Image or something like that, you know, an IDW or Boom, you've kept it yourself. You're frankly making more money by kickstarting it if you're doing it right.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it's still absolutely possible. It's actually the way that most of us doing it this way make our living.
Yeah, absolutely.
But one more thing I want to address before we go, though, Brad, is Patrick specifically used the phrase gravitas comics.
Yeah.
But then, Patrick, you said Invincible or Saga, which I don't associate as gravitas comics.
Right.
And so I just want to say that not all long form is gravitas. To me, gravitas is, I've described it before, like broccoli comics. Like, they're important. They have they're making society better. No one wants to read them, but they're making society better. You know what I mean? They're going to win 6 Eisners, but no one is reading them. That, to me, is a gravitas comic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? A comic that's making change, but it's really not a great story, and it's, you know what I mean? Like, that kind of thing. So for me, Invincible and Saga are more popcorn kind of stories, in the sense that, like, you're like a popcorn movie. You're constantly going to town on the popcorn because you're so excited and your heart beats pumping. Anyway, I don't know why that was important to make that distinction. But for me, gravitas comics are different than what Invincible or Saga are. Brad, am I getting that wrong?
No, I think you're right. But I don't think it changes our answer. In other words,
not at all.
Even if it was a gravitas comic, my advice would be the same.
I will say, though, that if it truly is a broccoli comic, that's one of the few times where it might be hard to Patreon that, in the sense that, are people checking in every week for a bit of basically medicine? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's harder, I think, to Patreon a gravitas comic.
I think if you're going to do that, I don't know that it's harder, but you have to focus your messaging very, very clearly on something like that. In other words, if you're one of these people that goes out and say, hey, support me on Patreon, and you're doing something that at the basis is not super entertaining, that's going to be a heavy load for people. So if you're going to, if this is the thing that you've chosen to do, you're going to have to think very, very clearly about your messaging when you're out there on social media and attempting crowdfunding, because now your messaging is very, very important to the success of this overall operation.
Right. Whereas in contrast, I think Invincible or Saga are low-hanging fruit to a comic that could have been done as a webcomic.
Yeah.
Keeping in mind to just make every update satisfying, make every update have an important or meaningful moment on that page, you could absolutely have Invincible or Saga-type comic on the web. All right, Brad, let's move into the next topic. Thank you for letting me take that little digression there.
Oh, not at all. Now, we've got a great lettering dilemma coming up. This is going to be good. So listen to how this works out. This comes in from Alan Ellsworth, who says, "Hi, Brad and Dave. I have a rather interesting lettering dilemma." See, I told you. I have a character.
God, what a dad way to say that. See, I told you. All right. You kids all bucket up back there. All right, let's get going. Come on. We said we're going to leave by 9. It's already 9:30. Let's go.
"I have a character," says Alan, "who is a gregarious little girl with a huge imagination, and she often does voices for her stuffed animals. But I am having trouble conveying that. I've thought about putting two balloon tails on the balloon, but I feel this may be a bit confusing. I plan to only do this for the first page or so, just to establish that she is doing the voice for the stuffed animal. How would you approach this?" So, Dave, we've got to basically what I'm going to, so we can shorthand this, she's doing ventriloquism. She's talking for herself, and then she's talking for the stuffed animal, inanimate object. Yes. How do you convey that in lettering? Alan's first blush is one word balloon with two tails. Let's take that first, see what we think about that, and then offer some thoughts.
Yeah. Okay. So two tails, I think I would immediately dissuade you of that idea, because two tails in my mind is a Greek chorus style of speaking. It's two, three, four people all chiming in on the same phrase. It's like happy birthday when someone walks in and the six people in the room all have the same tail going up to the one balloon.
Yeah. Six tails, one balloon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I didn't know that sounded like a weird joke. Sorry about that. So let me step back a little bit and say, I would dissuade you of the two tails to one balloon. I will step back a little bit and say ventriloquism is particularly hard to do well in comics.
Hard to say well in comics.
It's hard to say well, I tell you what. So you are setting yourself up for a difficulty, frankly, because every art form has things that it does well. Dance as an art form doesn't describe color well. It's really hard to describe color through the power of dance. You know, you can't get to it. And comics as a red art form is really hard to describe the specifics of ventriloquism in comics form. So now, having said that, having gently tried to dissuade you of the entire thing of ventriloquism as a continuing bit in your comic, I will say there are techniques to do ventriloquism in comics. Some are a uniquely colored word balloon. I think if everyone has a standard white word balloon with a black trim and your ventriloquist voice has, say, a light blue with a red trim, and that's consistent all throughout, people will figure that out.
Right.
Option two, I think, would be quotes around the spoken ventriloquist text. So if it's like, "Hi, I'm Little Bitsy," and Little Bitsy, you know, all of that has quotes around it, that helps. I think you can also do the shape of the word balloon. So if everyone else has a standard sort of oval type or oval adjacent type balloon, but the ventriloquist voice has either pentagon, septagon, octagon, some kind of, you know, angled shape or a square shape, for example, that could work. Brad, other ideas for what they could do?
I like everything you've said, but I'm going to add, because you didn't say it specifically and it needs to be noted, the tail has to point to the girl's mouth. Not to the stuffed animal.
Yes. The because otherwise it's just Calvin and Hobbes.
Even if it's if you use colors and fonts and quotes and all that other stuff, the tail still has to come back to that girl's mouth. This is one of the very, very few times when I would advocate using a different color for your word balloon or a different font. I usually throttle back on that in my own aesthetic very, very strongly, because it's something that you can get out of hand with very quickly. So I throttle back. I'm very, very careful on that sort of thing because, again, legibility is the key issue in comics. It's one of the most important things. We always tell people, if people can't read your comics, they're not going to read your comic. And
well, Brad, I think that's actually on the 20 Comics Commandments, now available at Comic Lab Cash Grab.
Because
it's all about friendship.
For picking that up. but you don't want to get cutesy that often. I don't personally like the idea of different colored word balloons. Not not only as an aesthetic thing, but because also then we start to get kind of full of our own conceit. And then you'll have situations where you'll have like a blue word balloon floating out with no character nearby. And then you ask the artist, well, who's talking there? And they say, well, Ralph, obviously, because Ralph always has blue word balloons. And it's like, I wasn't sitting here memorizing word balloons. You can go too far with that. So I would.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Like you're giving a reader a job at that point.
You're expecting the reader to be key coding and memorizing which character has what color at all times. So you can kind of lead yourself down the road of making some really bad decisions. But in my case, I would, I've got two thoughts for you. Number one, I would try, if I was doing this, I would always try to set up a call and response type of dialogue in that the girl asks a question and then there's a response that sprouts out from the main word balloon and has, you know, some kind of either color and or font difference. So it's basically a compound word balloon. Her word balloon connected with a tail, and then the stuffed animal's word balloon with one tail pointing down to the girl.
You know, this is so subjective that my counterpoint doesn't really matter, perhaps. But boy, I would strongly advise against that, actually. I would make the balloons separate, both tails pointing towards the little girl, because in my mind, again, totally subjective choice. In my mind, I would want them to feel as separate as possible. Like, well, hello, Brad, it's me, Little Tipsy. Hi, Brad, it's me, Dave Kellett. I would want those two phrases to be separate, but both pointing to my face. Do you know what I mean?
Because that's interesting. I'm just saying it
subjectively. Who knows which one of us is right?
I disagree 100% because I think they've got to be connected because they're both coming from the same mouth.
Well, see, to me, that battle is won by having both pointing at the little girl.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and it's weird that you and I, it's so subjective. And how weird and random a problem is this in comics of like trying to do ventriloquism? But keep going.
Yeah. And the other thing that I would want to do is to make sure that the stuffed animal's voice balloon is as close as possible to the stuffed animal's head. Like, this is no time to start getting fancy and floating these word balloons all over. You want to keep those as close to the different characters' heads as you possibly can, because you're taking on a tremendous amount of heavy lifting in trying to get this concept across. Okay. So I want those word balloons to be as close, whether you decide to connect the two with a compound word balloon like I'm talking about, or whether they're two separate word balloons that both have two tails pointing to the girl's mouth like Dave's talking about. Those word balloons, I think, have to come very close to the characters' heads so that you can set up that as well. But even more than that, so in your question, you say that you're only going to do it for a page or two to establish that she's doing the voice for the stuffed animal. So you are in a real dangerous zone here. Okay. Because number one, you're assuming everybody's going to read page one and experience page one before they experience page 12. And you know that that's not going to happen. Web publishing, that's not going to happen. So you think that we're all going to read page one and we will understand that this is the thing that's happening, when people, due to the obvious natures of web publishing, they're not going to come in on page one. You can't make them come in on page one. So this is going to have to be a decision that you think very, very carefully about, because this idea of having the girl speak for a stuffed animal, I'm going to tell you right now, you've got to be so sold on that idea. You have to be hyper fixated. This has got to be something that you cannot live without, because it's going to dictate how you do every panel in this entire comic. It's going to make all your storytelling 2 to 3 times more difficult than it really should be. And it's going to make it hard for people to understand what's going on. You are taking on a task that is monumental. I hope it's worth it. If I was like your editor, if I was giving you suggestions, I would be working day and night to talk you out of this entire concept. The entire thing, I tell you to find another way to do it, whether it's Calvin and Hobbes, where these stuffed animals actually talk for themselves. or something, I'd be looking for any way I could to talk you out of it, because it's going to make it so hard for people to gain entry into your comic that it's almost going to be a completely uphill pursuit.
Yeah, I like Brad. Here's what I will say. If you go with this, and again, it's going to be hard to do because comics do not do ventriloquism well. If you go with this idea, I think, like Brad, you have to be very sold on it, because I don't think you can walk away from this on page two or three. You have to be very consistent and, frankly, lay down rules that are kind of set in stone, because this is going to very easily confuse new readers or casual readers who are like, wait, what's happening again? Who's talking? I don't, you know, just imagine all the comics that you casually drop in on every once in a while. And you want those people, by the way, and you want to slowly win them over. But if every time they read, they're like, wait, who's talking here? Is the bear alive, or is the bear, is this okay? But like the shtick that worked for Calvin and Hobbes, one of the reasons why it worked is we've all been children, and we all invested our toys with a personality. We all remember what that is, right?
Right.
And that truth, the reality of the false voice that our toys might have, was so real for us as a kid that it could manifest as a real voice. And so the reasons why Hobbes worked is the voice emanated from Hobbes. It wasn't from Calvin. It was from Hobbes itself. And so it took all of us, if we're honest about it, it took all of us about 20 or 30 Calvin and Hobbes before we go, I got it. It's not the tiger's not real. It's just in the kid's voice. All right, here we go. Now I'm in.
And that is precisely why you can't use Calvin and Hobbes as an example here.
Right. It's a different shtick.
Right. And it was a newspaper comic. It was delivered completely different. It was published different. It was handled different than a web comic. You can't bring Calvin and Hobbes in.
Well, and here's why that shtick also worked. And a lot of people forget about this, too, is that even if you forgot, or even if you never realized that Hobbes was not a real living creature, it still worked, because 80% of comics on a newspaper comics page have animals talking or familiars talking. Yes. So if Hobbes was alive and was actually talking, everyone was like, yeah, that's fine. It's a comic strip. There's a talking tiger. Right? That's fine.
Yep.
But for those that remembered the first year of the run, of course, Calvin is the one planting Hobbes's voice. It doesn't exist. Hobbes doesn't exist. Hobbes is not real. And so what I'm getting at there is it worked both ways. Whereas this is tricky. Ventriloquism is tricky. It has to work. It has to specifically work. And it has to work even in weird situations, all the different permutations that a comic strip can exist, where characters are off screen, characters are walking in, characters are carrying a thing. Mm-hmm. There's other objects in the way between you and the bear. Well, now the voice bubble has to go in a unique place in the panel. That makes it trickier is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
And so ventriloquism is hard to do and hard to do well. And one of the reasons why I said you're going to have to stick to the rules is that's desperately important to keep the rules consistent, or else you're going to have readers going like, wait, who's talking now? What's happening? Yeah. I'm confused.
Take it from the king of the dense comic theme and the dense comic. What's the word I'm looking for?
Well, frankly, this is a hat on top of a hat.
Yeah,
is that ventriloquism in a comic? Most people will allow for a character having its own invested voice, even if another character is creating it. But ventriloquism specifically is an extra wrinkle on top of that that makes it harder to get into.
Here's the point that I wanted to make, though. Take it from the king of the dense, opaque comic theme and the comic concept. And that would be me, who did a comic strip about a comic strip starring a gargoyle. Okay. I had a comic strip that was being shot like a TV show. And the comic was within a comic. If somebody would have tried to talk me out of that, in fact, people did, and I didn't listen because I wanted to do this so bad. I it was in my head how it could be. Take it from the king of making an opaque decision on your comic. It doesn't pan out. I had such an image in my mind of how this could be. I did not have the ability to translate that for my readers. I didn't have the ability to convey that for my readers. I was thinking about it the way a TV show would play out, right? Where the camera would pan around and you'd see all this stuff happen. I didn't have the art skills. I didn't have the art chops. I didn't have the writing skills. And I had a very opaque idea that I was trying to convey. In other words, by opaque, I mean hard to understand quickly. I've made this mistake. I can see this mistake coming up Broad Street. I would be working very hard to talk you out of this and try to find another way to do it. Cause I know where this ends. 4.5 years of a comic that just did not take.
Yeah. And I think, that's especially helpful advice because what Brad is basically saying is he's in a little way making fun of himself so that you can learn from it, which is basically the kindest advice you can give is like, I have made this mistake. Do not make this mistake. And I think this, which both Brad and I would say, look, if this is something you want to do, go for it. Go with God, go have fun and invent your way out of it. But I think what Brad is really saying is, even if you can make it work, it might be a middling success in terms of comic communication. Like it's still going to be tricky to have a consistently ventriloquist voice in a comic. My only other thought, and Brad obliquely mentioned this too, is that I usually try to dissuade people of using a unique font because I'm always afraid of that Walt Kelly pogo look of like, what are we all on LSD? Why does everybody have their own font? What's going on here? And like Walt Kelly, I don't know what he was doing. It was such a beautiful artist, but the fonts, Walt, God rest his soul. What was he doing, Walt? But in this unique case, I honestly think that a unique font might be the saving grace that you're looking for because it's so hard to do a unique ventriloquist voice.
Yeah.
Maybe you're going to need to use a couple tricks of a slightly different colored word balloon and a different font.
Yeah.
But like also, I'm imagining one last wrinkle, Brad, that we haven't even talked about. Let's say this becomes an established comic. You're now 2 or 3 years into the comic. And this stuffed animal needs to have an internal thought, a monologue in order to set up a joke, right?
Oh.
How do you do that? Do you do is it still a thought bubble going to the little girl, but with a different colored balloon, with a different font? I mean, it just gets chewy. You see all the different iterations where it's going to get chewy for a reader to understand it.
What happens when the stuffed animal has to talk, but the girl's not in the room? I mean, there's...
Holy shit. I don't know why that made me laugh so hard. She's at school. What's the little bear doing?
Now what's the animal going to say? I side with Dave. If you want to do this as a creative objective and you're really sold on it, then go for it. And by the way, prove us wrong.
Yes,
do a comic
prove us wrong.
That wins awards and has 100,000 followers. We would be the first people to stand up and cheer for you and say, boy, were we wrong about that.
Yep.
But boy, oh boy, think about this one. You're taking on an awful lot. You're making this job a lot harder than it might even need to be.
Yeah. And I think the best advice, frankly, is Brad's, which is that he has walked this road himself.
Yeah.
And it can be made to work, but it's a stumbling solution.
Yeah,
and it's not going to get you to where you want to go, I think. And I frankly applaud Brad for using his own career as an example. Thanks, Brad.
Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics.
So, Dave, this is the perfect time to remind people that this show is brought to them in part by our good friends, the folks over at Wacom.com, W-A-C-O-M, the makers of the portable, powerful, professional Wacom One.
I love the pee pops. I can't overcompensate how much I love those pops of the pee. The powerful, portable, protective, personable Wacom One. No, legitimately though, we are as we always say every week. It is the perfect sponsorship for this show. It is honestly, it's like my metabolism being sponsored by water. It's like, hey, hooray! This is the thing we already enjoy. This is great. No, I love Wacom. We have three here in the studio. They are great. Brad is using them on his deck now. although winter is coming, Brad. Much like Game of Thrones, winter is coming. Soon you will not be able to use your Wacom out on the deck.
I've got a gas-powered fire pit out there. I'm actually welcoming autumn because I'll put that pit out there, and we've got blue stones in it to look like a wizard's brazier. It's going to be perfect.
A wizard's brazier. I love how much you enjoy saying wizard's brazier. Kids, come on. Let's all sit by the wizard's brazier. Father's going to draw an evil ink. Come sit with me. Look, the stones look like a wizard's brazier. I suppose that's true. You could, we need to find out the cold tolerances of a Wacom One to see if they can handle a Philadelphia winter. Although if they're near the brazier, perhaps they'll be all right.
That's right. I'll be toasty warm and drawing away on my Wacom One on the back deck right up until the time it snows is my plan, is to get up, because I've really gotten to the point, thanks to my portable Wacom One, where I really enjoy drawing on the back deck. It's a nice place to get a little fresh air, enjoy. I've been putting shiny objects out for the crows in case I get a chance to make any friends. There's a whole nature thing going on in the back of my Philadelphia deck.
Talk about an angle that I did not see coming. I've been leaving little shiny objects out for the crow. I really miss the contact of other human beings. I'm not doing so good on year 2 of the pandemic. Anyway, some of the birds and I have become friends. Let's move back to the show now. All right, here we go. I haven't touched another human being in 2 years, but Mr. Pickles, which is the biggest crow, he and I have become good friends. I've left him many bottle caps, a couple of paper clips. He brings me rocks. I bring him shiny objects. Mr. Pickles and I are great friends. Anyway, back to the show.
And to think it wouldn't be possible without the portable Wacom One.
So back to the show. All right, Brad, I've got the next question for us from Dean Young over at patreon.com/comment. Wait, Dean Young, wasn't that the maker of Blondie?
Yeah, I believe so. I had the same reaction. It's like, oh my gosh, Dean Young giving us questions. This is wonderful.
Dean, I loved your work on Blondie. Great work. Yes. That was a great 35-year run. All right, so Dean Young writes in, hey guys, as I write my comic, I'm noticing that I usually average 5 panels per page. Is it possible readers will get bored or tired of this consistency, and can it result in a pacing issue? Thanks for all the advice, Dean. Brad, so this is a totally legitimate question. Brad, Dean finds that he is landing on 5 panels per page on average.
Yeah.
And is that going to be a problem, Brad, where people get to 5 and they go, another 5-panel comic?
Well, I think it all depends on what's in the panels. You know, in other words, if you're doing a good job of writing your story, and that story is creative and inventive and embracing, nobody's going to be sitting there counting panels, right? Now, if you're writing a story that's so boring that the readers are sitting there counting panels just to keep themselves awake and pass the time, then you've got bigger problems. But if you're doing a good job of making comics and making interesting things happen in those panels, I guarantee you, nobody's counting them.
I love the idea of counting panels. Like, I'm really enjoying this comic I'm reading. Oh, what's it about? 1, 2, 3, 4.
No, dude, give me that one again. I'm really enjoying this comic.
I'm really enjoying this comic I'm reading.
What's the next question?
Well, what's it about?
It's about 5 panels per page.
Oh my God. Was there ever a doubt that you were Fozzie Bear? Was that ever a question? Why did I even bring that up as a question? I want to go along with what Brad's saying. Think about your favorite comic of all time. Oh, was it Alpha Flight? Was it Calvin and Hobbes? Was it Watchmen? How many panels did your favorite page have? You know, no one cares. If the story is good, if the story is compelling, it's kind of like how Brad and I always talk about how one of the least impactful things, granted, not to saying it's not important, but one of the least impactful things to a good story is panel construction or uniquely shaped panels or panels that are odd, because no one's going like, I didn't love the comic, but those panels were constructed really well. Yeah. And the same is kind of true with panel count per page. 5 is a perfectly acceptable panel count for a page. I can see why you would do it that way. The first panel tends to be a splash, and then the next 4 kind of conversational, or the first 4 conversational, and then you're leaving with a big splash of a much bigger panel. I can see why. What I'm saying is I can see why you're ending up on 5. But all that to be said, to Brad's central point, it does not matter if the comic is good. That's all that matters.
That's the thing that you really want to be putting your time into, not stuff like panel count and all that other stuff. Spend your time making sure that that story's good, that you're delivering it well. And again, things that we've talked about before, that you're doing good lettering and stuff like that. I would not get bogged down into counting panels, because if you're doing a good job with the comic, no one's going to be counting those panels.
No, not at all. Just out of curiosity, though, Brad, how many panels average? Because you do your Evil Inc. pages in two installments so that you get two web installments out of it, right?
Right.
But not speaking of the installments, speaking of the actual pages, how many panels does an average Evil Inc. net out to?
On average, 14.
Wow, really?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Now you're doing comic book format, right? Like traditional comic book.
And I'm also, when my books are larger format, right? They're more of like a European graphic novel, right? I'm not doing a digest or anything like that. So 14 panels fits very comfortably on one of my pages. And it generally turns out to be like seven panels on seven panels. I've got like an odd number, so I don't have my gutters lining up, and that makes it very easy for me to do. But yeah, I've got easily your typical Evil Inc. page, 14 panels, and there will be several pages in a row that will be 14, 14, 14, 14. It's not an issue.
And how often, this is just more of a curiosity, how often do you allow yourself a major splash page in Evil Inc.?
Whenever I need to. For example...
Because doesn't that represent a day that you're done far quicker, or does that tend to be much more work for you? You put a lot more love into it?
It could go either way, quite frankly. I've had it go either way, where it's like, oh gosh, why did I do this? It's way more work than I intended. And sometimes it's like, oh, geez, this made for a real easy day. You know, it just depends. But it comes down to what's needed for the story.
Right.
And like, for example, I have started doing splash pages and cover illustrations just because I like the way that adds to the book. It doesn't do me a whole lot in terms of that day of reader retention or audience building. I know that when I post it that day, it's pretty much a miss on those issues, but I do like it for the book. So I give myself that option. But like, for example, there was last week at the bottom of the page, I wanted to zoom in on somebody holding an iPhone because it was all about what was on the screen of that iPhone. Well, that ended up being about four panels worth of space. And ended up being and ended up being a vertical shape. So there was a strong vertical that took up half of that space and then four panels to the right of it. Okay. So that was a much different layout than I usually do, but the story needs dictated it. It made for a very interesting scene. It made for an interesting shape. It gave me all the visual information that I needed, and I went with it. Yeah. But if I'm being honest, 9 chances out of 10, I'm splitting that up into 2 7 panel half pages and doing most of my thinking about what's going in those panels. I don't give that 7 another thought.
Right. When you get to one of those layouts where it's like the zoom in of that takes up 4 panels of space and you're drawing it out on the deck.
Yeah.
Do you ever turn your Wacom 1 a little bit and then lift up a shiny object just so you can ask Mr. Pickles what he thinks of it? Just to have just one moment of your day where you're talking to another person. Or, Mr. Pickles, I'm done with the close-up zoom. Can you... And they come down and they bring you a pebble and you give them a bottle cap. And then they have a look over the Evil Inc. And they tell you what they think.
You can laugh all you want.
Oh my God, you're going to die on this hill. I thought you were going to let it go, but no, you're doubling down. Oh my God. Are you about to tell me a Mr. Pickles story where you give him a bottle cap and he comes down?
I got so excited when you said bottle cap because I hadn't thought of those. I've been leaving quarters and they've been dropping down and then getting lost in the alley. So I'm losing money here, but bottle caps is brilliant because they don't know.
Crows love anything they can shiny and they can grab with their beak, and a bottle cap is perfect. Yeah, yeah.
No,
why am I helping you with this weird? Oh, I shouldn't be contributing to this. Oh yeah, this is like the end of Nikola Tesla's life. Just Brad talking to pigeons in his hotel room in New York. Oh God. Oh my God. You doubled down on the damn crow thing. That was amazing. Oh, I didn't even think of bottle caps. No, this show is turning out to be very helpful in all sorts of ways.
I'm glad I showed up today.
All right, Brad, let me jump us into our next question. And by the way, Dean, I think we summarized that one fairly cleanly. But really, the story is what matters, not the panel count. And both Brad and I wish you all the best of luck with it, because it sounds like five panels is working out just great for you. So that's good.
Yes.
All right. Moving on to our next question from Stephen Barry over at patreon.com/comiclab. Stephen writes, hi, guys. What are your recommendations for learning the math behind business? Like inventory projections, estimating business expenses, etc. Thanks. This is a great question, Brad. What are your thoughts on this one? Business expenses and the numbers behind business. How do we suggest Stephen jump in on that?
I've got one book that I recommend very strongly. It's a book that I actually assigned when I was doing an arts entrepreneurship class for Hushin College. And it's called Arts and Numbers, A Financial Guide. I'm going to try that again.
Not cut that. We are keeping financial in there. How can we get rid of financial?
It's called Arts and Numbers, A Financial Guide for Artists, Writers, Performers, and Other Members of the Creative Class. It's written by Elaine Grogan Latrell, and it's very, very good in terms of talking about exactly what the title says, keeping track of your finances for an artist. For example, Dave, is this familiar to you? I was reviewing this book, and it's got a great chapter about budgeting as a freelance artist or a self-published artist. Budgeting, and here's the example. You're working from month to month. You've got some of your expenses down, and then something happens and you get a $200 revenue that you weren't planning, right? Mm-hmm. Like somebody bought a whole bunch of original art, and now this month you've got $200 that's extra. And then your wife says, hey, can we go to the movies? And you say, of course we can go to the movies. I got an extra $200. So you spend $50 on the movies. And then she says, oh, you know what? I was thinking about, this extra thing that we could get. And you go, of course we can get the extra thing. I've got an extra $200. So you spend $50 on the extra thing. And then by the end of the month, you've spent $50 on this because you had an extra $200, and all those extra $50 adds up to $400. And now you're $200 in the hole, because every decisions that you made was based on that extra $200. Have you ever experienced? I know I've experienced that. Has that ever happened to you?
Well, no, because what I do is I have a series of crows that I have trained to bring me dollars that they steal from various tips on outdoor restaurants. I've trained my crows. You haven't gotten that to that stage with Mr. Pickles yet, but I have trained my crows. I make an extra $250, $300 a month on dollars that crows bring me. So that's where I'm going to suggest that you get going on that. No, as far as budgeting, absolutely. Yeah, you get too excited is what I hear you saying. To Stephen's larger question, Brad's recommendation is excellent. And there are a few other books in the market that's specifically geared towards, hey, we know you're an artist, but you would like to learn about business. Here's what you can do. I will say that my own path, and one of the ways that I recommend doing both business decisions and learning the math behind business decisions, is to make manageably sized mistakes.
Yeah.
So by that, I mean with smaller business decisions, smaller amounts of money, like, hey, I'm going to try a run of t-shirts, or I'll try a run of magnets, or I'll try this or that. By doing a couple of smaller projects, you can learn the numbers of both cost of goods sold, expenses along the way, how to do shipping, this and that, bada bing, bada bang, such that when the time comes to kickstart your first big book and the expenses go from being in the thousands to being in the tens of thousands, then you're more ready and have better training on the real world math behind what you've done over the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
For me, that was my own personal journey, that it was better to make smaller projects happen, smaller manageably sized mistakes happen, so that I could learn from it and take it on to bigger projects. Brad?
Absolutely. And that's really the best answer. I mean, I do stand by this book, but the best answer that you could possibly get is that you're going to have to make mistakes month to month and learn from them and until you get your feet on the ground. And Dave's choice of words is absolutely spot on. Small, manageable mistakes, right?
Yeah,
and you're going to have to make a few of those and keep good notes, good records from month to month. I would suggest doing a monthly profit loss statement, so you can see from month to month, where's the money coming in? Where's the money going out? Right. And over the course of your first year, maybe even the course of your first 2 years, you'll start to see patterns, especially if you're writing this stuff down and taking good notes. That's half the battle, because then after you've been into your third and fourth year as a business person, you'll start to see, okay, we're coming into July. I know what I can expect based on the previous Julys. Mm-hmm. I'm coming into the end of the year. I know what I can expect because this is what happened before. Your best bet in this whole endeavor is your ability to keep good records, to keep yourself on track with those records, and then to just review them, because that's going to be your best guide for the future.
Boy, I'm really glad you mentioned records, because A, that is true, but also I can add my own little addendum onto records, which is find a way to capture your thought process behind certain decisions. And I'll tell you what I mean. Sometimes 2 or 3 years on from now, you know that 3 years ago you produced a run of magnets or you produced a run of pins, right? Mm-hmm. And you know they were successful, so you're like, I'm going to do it again. Well, the problem is you forget why you made certain decisions and you kind of have to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
And so if you have a little notation, like just a README file in whatever folder that you created those pins are, and the README says, hey, look, the reason why in 2018 we did the shipping this way was because bada bing, bada bang, bada bang. The reason why we went with producer A versus producer B is producer A was offering a discount, but make sure you get a counter quote from producer B because they still had a closed price, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So those kind of notes are helpful to future you in terms of getting better at the math, because you'll remember what the decisions were that led you to the first decision 3 years ago. So I will wholeheartedly echo Brad's idea about keeping good notes, keeping good records, but also making a message for future you to remember why you made certain decisions so you can learn from it if you have to.
Yeah, leave yourself a few messages in a bottle, in other words.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, that's true.
Give yourself messages.
That's true.
Well, listen, Dave, we've got another question here, and I think we've got time. Let's talk about Tyler's situation. A Patreon backer, Tyler, writes, I overordered more than 50 copies of my comic book when I did a Kickstarter a few years ago. Now they sit on my shelf, reminding me of my mistake. Without destroying them, what are some ways I can get them into people's hands?
This is a good question, because it is a truth universal and worth acknowledging that we have all over-ordered at some point.
Yep.
Every single one of us. And by the way, it's not just individuals. We've had publishers that over and or under order runs of books as well. Mm-hmm. And so it is a common mistake that it's a weird mercurial anti-science to try to decide how much to produce. Sometimes you're like, I don't know, it's a whisper on the wind. Do I produce 4,000? Do I produce 5,000? Do I produce 1,000? Do I produce 500? I have no idea. And so I'm only saying that so that you don't feel alone in this. Right. I have a book. I mentioned it on the show in the past. Uh-huh. It was book 7 of Sheldon. And for whatever reason, I was feeling so full of myself. I was like, I tell you what, my career is really going good. I'm going to order, I don't know what it was. It was like an extra 2,000 or 3,000, way more than I needed.
Yeah.
In addition to the thousands that I did need. And so it was a book, Brad, called Still Got It. And guess what, Brad? I still got it. I still got the book.
I still got it.
Oh boy, do I still got it. So I'm only mentioning this so you don't feel alone. We have all done this. And in my case, we still got it. I ordered thousands more than I needed, not just 50. So here's my top suggestion, which is pay it forward with kindness. And here's what you can do. Anytime somebody orders anything from your store and it doesn't necessarily cost you more to include it in your shipping, like if it's an extra 30 cents to include it in your shipping, throw it in. What a kindness to do to pay it forward and say, hey, thanks for shopping at my store. And you can cut out an 8.5 by 11 printout that can have little strips of things that just say, hey, as a thank you, I threw in a little something extra. Let them know that it wasn't a mistake, because a lot of people will email you and be like, hey, I got something by mistake. Should I send it back?
Right.
And you want them to know at the time they open the package, this is an extra gift from me to you. Thank you. I think personally, that's one of the best ways to get rid of an over-purchased item. Brad, any other ideas?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to drop back to sales just for a moment, because although Tyler doesn't necessarily say that he's tried to sell them, he doesn't say that he hasn't either. He's just saying that they're on his shelf. So just to make sure that we're covering all of our bases, your first instinct is to promote the book at its retail price and just give it another round of promotion, right? Use it just flat up or straight out promote it. That's your number one. Number two, discount it and promote it, right? Put in a significant discount. You're still making a couple bucks of profit, but you're getting them off your shelf and people are paying you to do it. That's your second one, is a discount. Number three, packages. Okay. So if you've got a book that's selling really well, you package it with the book that you've got extras on, you give them a discounted price, a special deal. Now you're boosting the sales of the book that does well, and you're getting rid of the book that doesn't do well. And so a package deal on all three of these is obviously got to be paired with a significant promotional push. But I think that's your first objective, is to get paid for getting rid of them. After that, yes, I'm with Dave 100%. I would just slide these into a book package, or I'm sorry, I would just slide these into a box along with somebody that had already ordered something else. Like Dave said, put a little note in there saying, hey, here's a little something extra for you because you're awesome. And you can never go wrong there. Here's one thing I don't want you to do. Don't start sending these books to Patreon backers. Remember, you never ship physical items on Patreon unless you're really at an upper tier reward. And why do I say not to do that, even to your top tier members? Because you don't want to set up an expectation, right? Because once you do that one time, then the person's like, oh, that was really nice. I wonder when that's going to happen again. And if you can't follow that up, you yourself set up that bad expectation. So I would not suggest sending it out to your upper tier Patreon backers, but I would suggest throwing it into somebody that's purchasing something in the manner that Dave talks about.
Yeah. So as Brad said, a sort of gift with purchase is a great way to do it. You can do a discounted price. That's another one. You'd be surprised by how many things you can move just by offering free shipping within the U.S. Obviously, you don't want to offer free shipping internationally. That'll bankrupt you. But free shipping within the U.S. is a very achievable thing, especially with a book that can be sent media mail. I would recommend that. And then buy one, get one free there. Sometimes that works. I don't necessarily recommend it, but there's a lot of standard sale techniques that you can use. And if none of those work and you still don't want to destroy them, two things that I would recommend that I have used in the past that are good for the world and they make your heart happy. Dolly Parton runs an excellent charity in the South of getting books to kids. And so if your books are family friendly or age appropriate to teens, maybe you can let a charity like Dolly Parton's Book Exchange. She does. I'm not joking, Brett. She gives out literally millions of books to kids in the South. It's a really good charity. Another one that I did recently with Drive with Kickstarter is the Comics for Kids charity that goes to cancer centers and children's hospitals. And by God, I think children's hospitals right now could use the help in terms of that's a great donation. So if you don't want to pulp them, if you don't want to destroy them, which I think is a great idea, you can get them out to the world via charity. And two that I have used and recommend are Dolly Parton's in the South and then Comics for Kids out of the Midwest. So those are my two options.
Bottom line is you're talking about 50 books and books don't have an expiration date on them. They don't go sour in a few months. You don't have to stress out about managing this. And it's a very small number. It may look large on your bookshelf, but 50 is a small number. Yeah. This is nothing to stress out about. This is
don't
nothing
stress.
To worry
God, don't
about.
Yep.
This is something to kind of, this is something that I would take a look at more as a positive. You've got a nice little freebie or a nice little discount you can set up. This is nothing but potential. And if it doesn't work, it's only 50 books. It's not a big deal.
And listen, I don't know how much the average North American crow weighs, but If a crow has a sufficient wingspan, and they're probably mature, they're probably, it's probably going to be, you know, sort of the alpha crow. But if you can train them to individually lift the comic books, you can get these books into people's hands by sort of trading a bauble from the crow for a comic book. And you can have them all over. Now, listen, it's not going to be much farther than your current metropolitan area, but that crow will do what it can to get it out there for you. And I think that's a very viable option.
Yes. And the most strongest argument yet for foil stamp printing on your cover. If that doesn't convince you to do foil stamp printing, I don't know what it would.
Oh, man.
And on that note, you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been my friend, Mr. Pickles, a good-sized crow out of Philadelphia. He's been very helpful, and he'll trade you any baubles for a shiny stone or a bit of rock. And also his current new friend, Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my goodness.
No worries. You chime in whenever you want, Brad. Take your time.
And my good friend, Dave Kellett, the co-director of Strip, the comics documentary, and the cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And a big reminder, these are the last days, nay, the last hours of ComicLabCashGrab.com, the Kickstarter, the quick starter that we are currently running over on Kickstarter to bring the 20 Comics Commandments into the world, along with two new Comic Lab pins. We think you are going to love them, to have them great around your space. So go over and jump in while there is still time. There is mere moments left to go over to ComicLabCashGrab.com. And I will say the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by the wonderful Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
If you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, and you may hear your review featured on a future episode like this one. This is a 5-star review coming in from our friend Jack Reichel, who says, "The best and only podcast I listen to regularly." Jack says, "I'm not a podcast person, but I can appreciate a good episode of a good podcast now and again. Comic Lab, though, I've listened through every episode as well as just about every one of the Comic Lab Pro Tips bonus episodes on Patreon. Brad and Dave are funny and informative, not just to comic creators, but to any creatives and or small business owners of any kind. One of the best resources on the wide internet. Thanks, guys."
Hey, that is fantastic. Yeah. Thank you, Jack. I'm always pleased when I don't allow myself to read them before you read them on the show, because I'm sitting here like blushing, like, "Oh, that's nice. What nice words. Oh, I like that." But thank you, Jack. That is genuinely appreciated. We really appreciate the kind words. And I will say Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that like Mr. Pickles. Trow! Trow! Trow!
Music to my ears.
So, Brad, in your backyard, you have a wizard's brazier. Is that right?
That's right. That, not to be confused with a wizard's brazier. That's the next person over. And that's a whole different situation going on.
A wizard's brazier is Gandalf later on in his days. He's not as fit as he once was. But, you know, he's still got to fight the Nazgul. So he's getting on the wizard's brazier.
Abracadabra. Poof.
Poof. I find it is a small act of kindness that lifts these babies up. Ha 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 ha!